is Friday, December 14th, 2012. This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. I'm coming to you from the sunny suburbs of Chicago. Thanks for joining me today on RBN. Their website is republicbroadcasting.org. My website is spingola.com. During the program, email your questions or comments to spingola1@yahoo.com. Clint Richardson, a frequent guest on this program, will be speaking about his recent vaccine video in New York City this Sunday. For exact details, please visit his website at realityblogger.wordpress.com, and that's just one G, realityblogger.wordpress.com. Join others in the Spingola chat room by clicking on the chat room button on my website, spingola.com, or by going to spingola.chatango.com. We will take calls in the second hour after we open the phone lines at 800-313-9443. RBN listeners are aware of the Israeli state's terrorist activities against the Palestinians, which were occurring even before Harry Truman officially recognized it as a country. Because of the influence of AIPAC, the U.S. government has financed, supported, condoned, and largely ignored the Israelis' inhumane brutality, their economic warfare, and their ongoing slaughter of the longtime residents of that ancient land. However, courageous, compassionate individuals have heard the cries of distress. Starting already. Sorry, that's just me. I have a tender, tender heart. Have heard the cries of distress and desperation of the Palestinians and have gone to their aid at their own expense and at the risk of their own lives. One such person was Rachel Corrie. Sorry. On March 16th, 2003, over 9 years ago, an Israeli manned Caterpillar D9R bulldozer plowed her over as she was attempting to prevent the demolition of the home of a Palestinian family comprised of a pharmacist, an accountant, their wives, and five young children. Members of Rachel's family and the community established the Rachel Corrie Foundation for Peace and Justice to continue the kind of work that Rachel gave her life for. There is no greater sacrifice than to give your life for your friends, and Rachel, an extraordinary individual, did that. Even as a fifth grader, Rachel Corrie was a special, caring individual. We have an audio that we would like to play. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guests today are Cindy and Craig Corrie, the wonderful parents of Rachel Corrie. Their website is, and that is the Rachel Corrie Foundation for Peace and Justice. That website is rachelcorriefoundation.org. Cindy and Craig, welcome to the program.
For having us on.
Thank you. Thank goodness for commercials.
Well, we appreciate always your interest and the interest of your listeners in the work that we're doing and in Rachel's story. And we're approaching the 10-year anniversary of Rachel's killing. Just last night here in Olympia, we had a meeting with community members organized by one of the interns at the Rachel Corrie Foundation and by our project facilitator. We have a very small office, and they did a wonderful job putting a meeting together. So, you know, these things are very much on our mind, too, but we greatly appreciate the support of people like you and people all over the world.
You should have our support. And is the foundation still on East 4th Avenue in Olympia?
We are. We have a very small office in Olympia, but it's in downtown Olympia, a good place for us to be. We feel connected to our local community and things happening here. We're kind of, you know, in the heart of things. Olympia is the state capital. For those of you that don't know, it's about an hour south of Seattle. And while Craig and I spend a lot of time away from here in various ways, but doing a lot of speaking and traveling and that sort of thing, a lot of the work of the foundation happens here. And, you know, our work is widespread, too. It goes all the way, you know, to other parts of the world, particularly to Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza. But there's just a very strong connection between our community and that world.
I'm so glad that you have your community behind you, and that you have so many people who are willing to work with you. And you recently received a verdict in the court in Israel after you filed a civil suit, and that verdict came on August 28th, 2012. Is that the correct date?
Yes, it is. And there's sort of a long story behind that, but of course, we wanted to find out what happened to Rachel in some sort of unambiguous way, if we could, and we wanted to hold those that had culpability in that responsible in some fashion. We tried to do that at first through diplomatic means, so before we really got involved in a movement like that, when we're still mourning. Actually, the day after Rachel was killed, we're told that President Bush talked to then Prime Minister Sharon and was promised by the Israeli Prime Minister a thorough, credible, and transparent investigation into Rachel's killing with a report to the U.S. government. And several months later, the Israelis said that they had investigated the incident, as they call it, found no wrongdoing on the part of their forces, and declined to give any report to the U.S. government. It's still the position of the U.S. government that it was not a thorough, credible, and transparent investigation. After they declined to give any sort of report out, it was possible for some members of our family and members of the government to read a legal document that supported their contention that, or tried to support the contention, that there would be no sort of charges brought against the either the bulldozer driver or any of his chain of command. But we did have the right to a civil lawsuit. So we have tried to continue to push through diplomatic channels for a better investigation in Rachel's killing, and that's really what we're calling for there. But in the meantime, the only process that we can control and push forward is a civil lawsuit. So we filed that right at the end of the statute of limitations, which was 2 years after Rachel was killed. And it finally came to court in Israel, I think the first day of hearings in court, of listening to a witness, was on March 10th, 2010. There's no jury in Israel, so you just have a judge who can decide which days he wants to hear a trial, and he has other things to do during that time, competing trials and whatnot. So the last day, we had intermittent days of trial, and the last day that we actually were in court to hear a witness was, it was July 10th in 2011. So that's about 15, 16 months after the first day of trial, and we were actually living in Israel for about 8 months out of that time, off and on. And then, like you say, the final verdict, in which the judge, it's as if he had never heard not only our witnesses and our attorney, but not even the state's witnesses. The state did bring the bulldozer driver, the commander that was in the bulldozer sitting right next to him. There was another bulldozer there that day. It also had two people in it. And there was a armored personnel carrier, and the commander on the scene was in the armored personnel carrier. So they had, I think, Cindy, in a total of six witnesses from being out in the field on the scene that day. And what was extraordinary to me is that their testimony conflicted one another. It conflicted with what they had told to the people asking questions to the military people right after the time. They would even conflict with themselves as the day went on, and our attorney would put them in cross-examination. So it ended up with their testimony being close to incoherent, but that was ignored by the judge when he said that the military's investigation was faultless and that there was no fault on the part of the Israeli military, and then, in fact, that Rachel was killed as an act of war, which then, in his interpretation, said that nobody could hold the State of Israel responsible for anything that it does in an act of war, which, of course, flies in the face of international law. So there was a lot to object about in that verdict, but at least we did get to pull people onto the stand, you know, and we had colonels, so field grade officers of the Israeli Defense Force on the stand having to answer in the questions of our attorneys, and I think that was a real milestone in terms of people being able to question what goes on there.
And so the truth did come out. The judge simply just rejected the truth and essentially blamed Rachel for her own murder.
Well, I think there are a whole lot of holes left in it. What you could see, I think, is the, out from underneath the skirts of a cover-up, I guess I would say, you could see parts of the truth. But there would be a whole lot more questions that a person would want to have. Is one small example, I think, there was video taken by the IDF. They had a camera on the border. And about 12 minutes of that was released right after Rachel was killed. The Israeli TV and then subsequently to other filmmakers that were interested in this issue. They brought to court a 12-minute section of that video, but it was a different 12 minutes. It started a little later, so about halfway through the original one, and then they denied that there was ever any other film and refused to bring the entire film from that day to court. But they said in court under oath, and their attorneys kept saying there is no other tape, there's nothing else. Yet you could go into Israeli TV or into the Cinematheques as we were in court, and you could go see the rest of that film. So you could see, you know, that there was something going on there. There was a cover-up. And when asked, it took them, I think, over a week, Cindy may be able to correct me on this, for the Israeli investigators to get a hold of that film, because it was taken immediately by the superior officers in the Israeli Defense Forces. So the people responsible for that action held some of the best evidence that it might have been available, and then refused to give it over to the investigator. Apparently, if you believe the investigator, never gave all of it over to the investigator, and yet let out different pieces of it in different places. That never played out in court. We were able to get that into the newspapers after the court date. You know, there was we did a press conference, showed these different clips, and in one of the Israeli television stations ran with it, asked the attorneys for the state if there was any other tape. The attorney said there was no other tape, that they had put all of it in court. And then the television ran with the tape that the Israeli government said did not exist. They showed it. So that's sort of a local victory, but at least it gets something out on the record.
Amazing. And especially after that long of a case, over a year that you spent there, or that the case went on. And that is amazing. I mean, it's so obvious that they were withholding evidence. And even if that evidence had been presented, do you think that the case would have resulted in the same kind of a verdict?
Yes. to be completely honest, we knew we were in Haifa District Court. There are three layers to Israeli courts. There's a magistrate's court, the district court, and then the Israeli Supreme Court. And we knew that we were in the best district in Israel. That's what we had been told by people that know the system well, by being in Haifa District Court, which is somewhat more progressive. But we were also told from the beginning that our draw of judges probably was not going to be helpful to the decision.
Cindy and Craig Corey, the wonderful parents of Rachel Corey. The website for the Rachel Corey Foundation for Peace and Justice is rachelcoreyfoundation.org. Cindy, I'm sorry we went into a break. I hated to interrupt you. I just wanted to hear everything that you were saying. So.
It's quite all right. I think that the story of our work in Israel in the Israeli courts is complicated, and there's a lot to share about it. I was just pointing out that we had been, even though we felt it was not something we could really discuss, we had been told that while we were in the best district in terms of bringing a case like this, the Haifa District Court, that the assignment of the particular judge was not favorable for us. There probably would have been other judges maybe that would have handled things differently. And that's not unlike what happens in courts here in the U.S. either. I think anybody that finds himself in a court situation realizes that it's not completely unbiased in any way. So I held out, I think, maybe more than others, some hope for the judge, because in the course of being in the court for that very long time, all the way from March 2010 until the verdict in August of 2012, I felt like our family to some extent bonded with that judge. We sat, there were 15 different court sessions spread throughout that time. Craig, my daughter Sarah, and I were at every session. We heard every word. It all had to be translated to us because everything has to be said, and he is said in Hebrew, of course, in the court. There were English-speaking eyewitnesses from the United States and from the UK, but all of their words had to be translated into Hebrew, and all the questions to them were in Hebrew. They actually had to have translators who could tell them what the questions were. So it was, an intense and complex process while we were sitting there partaking in it. But we sat in a relatively small courtroom facing that judge every day, hearing the testimony. We were not able to see significant witnesses, the driver in the bulldozer, the commander in the bulldozer, and I always like to remind people that there were two people in the machine. The commander was the person who was really supposed to direct the operation of the bulldozer and to be a second set of eyes for the driver. Those two and then other personnel who had been on the ground that day were able to testify from behind a screen. That was because of an order by Ehud Barak, the Minister of Defense, actually way back in 2008, in which he said the identities of these people needed to be protected. We appealed that, but they did not rule in our favor. And even in the court, we asked, or our attorneys asked for us, if just our family even could watch the testimony of these witnesses, not the public, not the media. Our attorneys did get to see them as they questioned them, but our family did not. And that was difficult because they were, particularly hearing the Hebrew, I felt like we didn't get a whole sense, of who these people were. We heard no emotion in their voice that suggested remorse. I was, looking for for the humanity, actually, in these people that day. I remember it very well. And I remember coming out and just saying I heard nothing in their tone of voice and nothing in the words that were translated to me that suggested remorse on their part. There's an interesting article that people might like to look at written by Ed Sanders from the Los Angeles Times about that day in court. And he talks about something I did not see, but he could see the feet and the shoes of, I believe it was the driver who was testifying. And it was interesting to just read another person's perspective of what they kind of took just from watching the movement of the person's feet below this screen that the person was behind.
That's interesting. I will definitely look that article up. And we always think, well, shouldn't the accused have to face the accuser? I mean, this seems to be just a normal process here in America's courts, and I think that it's terrible that you were not able to see these people, but it does not surprise me that they did it this way. And given the circumstances of her murder and what these people were doing, were going to do, were attempting to do, that she was trying to prevent, I think that the outcome of the trial was kind of predictable. We will be right back. We'll hear a word from our sponsors. Be right back in 3 minutes. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guests today are Cindy and Craig Corey, the parents of Rachel Corey. And I had read that article, and I just brought it up again by Edmund Sanders. And before we went to the break, I mentioned that it seems like they would have come to this erroneous, unjust conclusion, because if they had any other conclusion, if they admitted their culpability and their responsibility for her murder, it would have been saying something about their entire operation, their military occupation of the Gaza Strip, and their slaughter of innocent Palestinians. Don't you think?
I think you hit right on it, and people that follow this sort of issue realize that the Israeli courts really do, that they're sort of the last defense of the Israeli Defense Forces in exonerating them from having any responsibility, not only for what they do in Gaza, but of course what's going on in the West Bank is slightly different, but still there's no review of what the military does. It's notorious that they're not held responsible for that. And, that bothers me in a lot of ways, but, and I didn't used to point this out before Rachel was killed, but I was in the U.S. military during Vietnam War. I essentially was drafted and went over there in 1970. I think it's really important that you hold the military responsible for what it does, and I think also that, and I know we did a lot of awful things in Vietnam, but my squad didn't, and we weren't, we were combat engineers, we weren't supposed to be shooting at people particularly, but it also, if you know you're going to be held responsible, it just sets up the whole chain of command so that before something happens, they work hard. If they're good, they work hard to make sure that it won't happen, and the people around me did. And while I don't think anybody ought to be in that position of being an occupying army and all that sort of thing, if somehow you find yourself as a draftee, as the Israeli soldiers are draftees, if you find yourself there, you ought to know what's expected of you. And one of the most difficult things in the military is to view the other side as human. And that just doesn't happen in Israel, and I don't think it happens here in the United States, as it should. But that's a requirement of the job, sort of. And so anyway, that's sort of an old draftee's view of part of this.
I just wanted to add that there is a report that was put out in 2010 by the Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem, and it's called Void of Responsibility. It's accessible online. But what it addresses is the fact that that the courts do contribute to the impunity that the Israeli military enjoys. And B'Tselem and other Israeli human rights organizations like Yesh Din have really been challenging that because the courts have a good reputation in Israel. And Craig and I, in fact, were told here, you know, that really by U.S. government officials, I think, that were looking, you know, for a way to deal with what happened to Rachel, having too much to do or have to do too much here right in the U.S., were advising us to go towards the Israeli courts because they have a fairly good reputation. But these Israeli human rights organizations point out that the record shows that very, very few incidents that are that occur in the occupied territories, in the West Bank, in Gaza, are ever investigated at all. There may be command investigations. In Rachel's case, there was a military police investigation. But the nature of those investigations is so inadequate and so poor that what it does is to create a situation of impunity for the military. I would just, going back to the trial itself, mention that the lead investigator in the case, military police investigator, did testify. And in his testimony, when questioned by our attorney, he stated that he believed that the Israeli military and government was at war with everyone in Gaza, including the peace activists. And this was the individual who was charged with being the lead investigator in Rachel's case. I don't see how any thinking person could think that there could be some objective result from what they would look at. And yet the judge, when he provided the verdict in the case on August 28, 2012, cited the investigation as being exemplary. I think that all just points to a system that very sadly allows things like what happened to Rachel and to so many others to continue, and that's really damaging to everybody in this region. I don't want to miss this morning having a chance to talk about Gaza and what's happening recently, but this just reminds me that I've had communications in the last couple of days from one of the activists who was with Rachel during her time in Gaza, not one who was with her on the day she was killed, but from a young woman who had been there prior. And that young woman is back in Gaza, and she just wrote to me about what's happening along the border with Gaza and Israel right now, where farmers are moving into the area to farm their farmland, and they've been so threatened in that area through past years. And after the recent conflict, after the ceasefire, supposedly they were going to be able to do more there. And they have been taking advantage of that, moving into the area to try to plant wheat and to do their farming. There are internationals going with them, but there are reports in the last couple of days about them being fired upon with live ammunition, with tear gas and that sort of thing. So I just wanted to bring that up because, you know, what happened to Rachel 10 years ago is important for us all to remember, but to know that all of this continues and that there continue to be people challenging what goes on there.
And the U.S. continues to send the Israeli state huge amounts of money. In fact, just since the recent military operation in Gaza, they have requested $643 million to replenish their military supplies. So we know that this is going to continue, and we've all seen the YouTube video showing these beautiful, once beautiful children who are soaked in blood because of the murder by these Israelis who seem to have no personal moral responsibility for the killings that they perform. This is just the most egregious thing. I cannot understand people who would murder other people, like your daughter and other people's daughters and sons.
Yeah, the latest attack on Gaza is another one that was preventable. I mean, actually, Cindy was leading a delegation to Gaza as that violence was escalating. We left Gaza on November 11th, and we were awakened at, I think, 1:30 in the morning when an Israeli bomb hit fairly close to us. I still think it was several miles away, but I remember the flash of the light, through my eyelids. I felt that a split second before the actual concussion of the bomb, but it was getting that violent there at that time. So it just continues. At the time that violence was sort of slowly increasing from, I think when we got there on the 5th, I believe there was a mentally handicapped Palestinian who wandered close to the border with Israel and was shot and killed on that day. And then a little later on Friday, I think we went to a Shaheed tent. So it's the funeral tent for a child, a 13-year-old boy, was killed in front of his home. Again, the home was, I would judge it to be about a kilometer and a half from the Israeli border. Israel said it shot at somebody that was acting suspiciously that day. They were actually inside Gaza. We don't hear that, but they had invaded Gaza with their bulldozers and were bulldozing, I believe, an olive orchard that was appeared to be about a three-quarters of a kilometer inside. This person that they said was acting suspiciously was a 13-year-old boy playing goalie outside of his house in the street. You know, I don't know what's more universal to a 13-year-old boy than playing soccer. They would call it football in the rest of the world, and less suspicious than that. And I think just holding out the humanity of each other. And, of course, people inside Gaza do fire some rockets, and they did, particularly as the hostilities broke out, they fired much bigger rockets into Israel. That's a violation of human rights. But I think we in the West particularly organize all that and have much larger, I mean, we have 1,000-pound bombs that are a whole different level of violence in the situation. And we all sort of make heroes of our soldiers, and yet, the highest cause of death, for instance, in the Israeli military, B'Tselem, Israeli group, says that the highest cause of death in 2004 was suicide. I think that's true of the U.S. military as well. So we're literally asking our young people to do things they cannot live with. And we need to, not just point the finger at others, but point the finger at ourselves when we do that.
Oh, absolutely. And we, of course, we hear about Israelis running over Palestinian children. And in the story that Edmund Sanders wrote for the Los Angeles Times, he talks about your daughter's murder, and the driver claims that he did not see Rachel, and yet he did run over her twice.
Yeah, I think in one of the contentions, our case was that either they purposely ran over her or that there was gross negligence. And the military's continuing defense was that they said you can't see in front of the blade. One of my responsibilities in Vietnam was being in charge of sometimes bulldozer operations out in the jungle, we weren't pushing down somebody's house, but you're responsible for what's in front of your blade. And if you cannot see there, if you have a blind spot, then you do something about it or you're negligent. To me, it's just cut and dry. If you say, well, I can't see, and you're moving 65-ton bulldozer when you can't see, that's negligent. And there are things that you can even purchase, I think, for a huge, fairly large sum, like $75,000 or $80,000. You can now purchase a group of cameras and a locking mechanism that if anybody's moving around the bulldozer, you can't move it. And something quite cheaper than that would be possible. So you'd have a camera in front of the blade and there's something inside the cab so you could see what's out there. And with that suggestion, they said that it would be distracting. You can't operate a bulldozer and, you know, look up at a camera every once in a while. I sort of wondered how the Israeli military drives a car without ever looking in a rear view mirror. You know, that would be distracting too. It's just clear that you could do all those things, but that's the sort of logic that the military uses and that was used in court.
Of course.
I think a revealing thing to us was that after Rachel was killed, the U.S. President Bush actually demanded a military police investigation happen in Rachel's case. And that, as I said, is unusual for most of the harm that's done to people, to Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. But there was a military police investigation in her case. So within a few days, soldiers were giving some testimony to these investigators. And the driver of the bulldozer, I remember clearly, spoke about how the distance that he could see in front of the machine, which was really quite a short distance, you know, that because the state's position now is that, you know, even though Rachel was standing there as they made the approach on this run, that they just didn't see her at all. And the earlier testimony really that they gave when they talk about these distances suggests that it would have been mostly impossible for them not to see her. But then when they came to court, their first evidence was written affidavits that they had put together with the state's attorneys. And that's what our attorney is able to question these witnesses on in court. In these affidavits, suddenly the distances had dramatically escalated, and in their oral testimony as well, the distance that they couldn't see had suddenly grown, you know, to be like 10 times greater than what the soldier had originally testified back in 2003. I think, too, what we saw throughout was that the high command were trying from the very beginning to respond to the U.S. government. Craig mentioned, and I'm not sure if it's clear, that the tape that they had from the border, which is it's fuzzy, it's you know, difficult to figure out things that are happening, and it does turn away from where Rachel was killed, 5 minutes before she was killed. But there are good questions about why that happened. Why did this camera that had been focused on that activity prior turn away 5 minutes before Rachel was harmed? But that tape was confiscated by high command, according to the testimony, not by the lead investigator. And those high commanders had that tape for over a week, and they determined what portions of it would be given to U.S. government officials to look at as they tried to explain what happened. And what we saw throughout is we still had the highest person in command who testified, who had responsibility that day, was still saying that Rachel was not run over by the bulldozer, but that something fell on her. And that was the story that they tried to put forth to the U.S. government from the very beginning. The soldiers on the ground, actually the commander who was in the APC vehicle that day, agreed with the photos that showed Rachel had clearly been run over by the bulldozer.
Exactly.
But that just points out, you know, some of what we were dealing with.
Sure. Cindy, we are going to a break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today are Cindy and Craig Corey, the parents of Rachel Corey. The website for the Rachel Corey Foundation for Peace and Justice is rachelcoreyfoundation.org. They are located in Olympia, Washington, and certainly they would be grateful for any support that you could throw that their way. Cindy, you were talking about, please pick up from where you left off. You mentioned the Bush administration, and we went to war against Iraq 3 days after Rachel was murdered. And I personally believe that was a war that the United States military perpetrated in behalf of Israel.
You're right about the timing of it. And Craig and I happened to be, because of where we were living at the time, we were in Washington, D.C. at the time. Our son lived in the area. We went there after Rachel was killed. We thought we would travel to Gaza to bring Rachel's remains home. And we were told very quickly that that would not be possible, and that was because of what was happening in the region with the war that was about to unfold. I think, we at the time opposed the war. Rachel had actively opposed the war with Iraq. I participated in my first large march. It was the last big war march on Washington, D.C. It was a Code Pink Women's March on Washington that was really the weekend, or the weekend before Rachel was killed. I'd never been in a march like that, a protest like that, but because of Rachel being in the region, because of how strongly we opposed the Iraq war, I made that trip. And also during that week, the following days, actually talked with some members of Congress, Rachel's representatives, with their staff members and with Congressman Brian Baird before she was killed to talk about the situation. So the timing, of course, was difficult in a sense because Rachel's story was pretty quickly pushed out of the news. And that may have been a blessing to us because we were, completely overwhelmed, and we kind of believed at the time that we would need to talk about it right away with people because the world wouldn't be paying attention at all. Certainly not 10 years later. We couldn't have anticipated that there would still be some interest in the story this far down the road. But we thought, it would be a matter of days or weeks and nobody would pay attention at all. As difficult as pursuing accountability in her case has been, we've certainly been supported by those who have continued to help us. And people made trips to talk to their members of Congress and so forth. And it's interesting that that's continued.
Yes.
Yeah.
All righty. We do have to interrupt, and we'll take a 60-second top-of-the-hour break, and we'll be right back after station ID. Welcome back. This is the second hour of Spingola Speaks. This is Deanna Spingola. Our guests today are Cindy and Craig Corey, the parents of Rachel Corey. The website of the Rachel Corey Foundation for Peace and Justice is rachelcoreyfoundation.org. It's located in Olympia, Washington. A caller just called in saying that there is breaking news of a shooting at an elementary school in Newtown, Connecticut, and there are 27 reported dead. A terrible, terrible tragedy. As far as the story of Rachel Corey remaining in the news or remaining a factor for those of us who care, which I would hope would be millions of people, It should remain a story as long as the Israeli government continues to respond, to escape responsibility and culpability for it. I think they owe you a huge apology. But I don't think you're ever going to get it. And it's a terrible thing. Terrible thing.
There's one thing that I would like to say. First, it's horrifying to hear about this school. I think that, our lives, and not my life personally, I'm very fortunate, but the lives of so many seem to be permeated with violence. And I think, we just have to keep looking for other ways. You brought up the Iraq war, and I can't address, I don't know what all the motivations were, for that war. I have my own opinions as well. But what we know is hundreds of thousands died early on in the beginning, or at least 100,000, I believe, within the first year. There was documentation of that, Iraqis. There were American soldiers who died, and we created a lot of destruction, instability, and we were dealing in a place, in a region that we didn't really understand, and of course there were no weapons of mass destruction. And I think whatever the situation in a place like this, I just would hope that the lessons are that we've got to find other ways. And I want to say, too, because I think we need to be somewhat careful when we're characterizing Israel, because I make a big distinction there between the Israeli government and Israeli people that I know personally who don't support their government's actions. Now, Craig and I are beneficiaries of that kind of point of view as well, because people say to us, we don't like, all over the world, we don't like American policy, but we like American people, and we sometimes think they're being far too generous, because we do have responsibility and we don't take responsibility for what our government's doing. And I think the same is very true for many Israelis. But I think it's important to know that that Craig and I have had the benefit of connecting with people there who are very courageous and are recognize all of the problems and are really standing in solidarity with the Palestinian people. And they're not enough. Unfortunately, a fairly small number comparatively, but I think it's always important to know that those folks are there. They were there for Craig and me in court, outside of court, and I think it. I think this, Craig mentioned the rocket fire. It's also important to know that those are human rights violations when those rockets are fired. I'd like to talk more about the why we shouldn't allow ourselves to kind of be diverted in how we address the situation when it gets reduced to rockets and bombs.
Exactly. We are going to take a 3-minute break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guests today are Cindy and Craig Corey, the parents of Rachel Corey. The website for the Rachel Corey Foundation for Peace and Justice is rachelcoreyfoundation.org. And I agree with you wholeheartedly, Cindy. I am totally anti-war, but I do recognize that there are many Americans who hate the idea of the military going into countries and bombing them back to the Stone Age. It is just terrible, just beyond terrible, and this kind of thing has been going on a smaller scale, as we just heard, with this shooting in Newtown, and it's going on in the Middle East, and it's probably more war is going to erupt in Iran and Syria, and it is preventable. It's just mass slaughter, but it is preventable.
I'm sitting here as we talk, and I'm looking at a picture that Cindy took in 2003 of a then 6-year-old girl that was behind the wall that Rachel stood in front of, and she's holding a pet rabbit in her hands, and she's now what, about 13, 14 years old. You know, she's managed to grow older, and I think of her. I think of the daughters of two Jewish Israeli people that helped us in court over and over again and became good friends. But they're now about a little bit older than when this picture was taken of the Palestinian girl. And I remember these. You know, one of these cousins is living in Tel Aviv and the other up in Haifa, and watching these little girls when we were at a party. They were giving a play. Yeah, and of course I didn't understand a word of it. They were talking in Hebrew, although each of them can speak English as a second or third language. But kids are the same all over the world, and I think our first duty as adults is to protect our children. And I think if you get to travel very much, you start to understand that they're all our children. It doesn't matter where they're born, where they grow up. They're all lovable. They're all quite the same in so many ways. They all do plays. They all want a capacity to love, whether it's a rabbit or a family member or whatever. And we have to cherish them, and we have to do everything we can to stop up the sort of violence that we have that we see around the world, and that we sometimes tragically bring home into our own, even a classroom.
Exactly. Most of these people in Newtown, Connecticut are children, and apparently they're just before the top of the hour, 12:57, more than 25 children, young children, were killed, and it's senseless. And as you say, children all over the world are the same. They're beautiful, loving, innocent, and we do need to protect them. And we're not, or we're trying to, but we have these governments that have different agendas, and somehow they don't represent us. They don't represent the best interest of anyone. Terrible thing. We do have some callers. Let's take a caller or two. Let's take Werner in Canada. Werner, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Well, there's not too much good news, and the way it looks like there's more and more bad news coming down the road. Unless people get a good knock on the head and get an awakening. You know, it's so terrible what happened to Rachel there. And I think the real saints, there are more saints living among the Palestinian people than that they are living now among the Israeli people. And when we just look at the history, what led to the establishment of the State of Israel, you know, ethnic cleansing, all actions that are considered to be in the international community considered to be criminal acts. How can any kind of a government still support this rogue state? It is a cancer for the Middle East, and it is a cancer, and this cancer will spread and has spread all over the world. And those that are supporting this kind of a government there in Israel, you know, they are basically metastasizing the cancer into their own countries, like in the NATO countries that are supporting Israel, the Israeli government. And when we just look at the figures, you know, before the establishment of the State of Israel, there were 1.5 million Palestinian people were living there, and 500,000 Jews that had settled over the previous 100 years, or some of them even longer there. And they were living in peace with the Palestinian people until those criminals came in and formed those gangs, the Ergen Gang and the Stern Gang, and did ethnic cleansing and slaughtering the Palestinian people. So they drove in terror. They drove them off their land, you know. And now the situation is where a small minority that was only 1/4 of the population, you know, where they now, you know, with the influx of most of those terrorists and those that call themselves settlers, they're actually squatters, you know. Now they occupy more than 91% of the whole territory. And when there a few years ago, Ahmadinejad was being misquoted about driving the state of Israel into the sea, this is exactly what the state of Israel is doing to the, and intends to do with the Palestinian people, drive them into the sea.
Okay. Berner, Cindy and Craig, would you like to respond?
I would like to just say a few things. You know, I think your caller shared a lot of information that is absolutely true and so concerning. And I'd just like to, because I feel like we have to find, you know, a positive way forward. I'd just like to comment last night at the meeting with people here in our community in Olympia. One of our Rachel Corrie Foundation board members, who actually grew up, spent part of her time in Egypt, her family is originally from Bangladesh, she looked at me and she said, I feel more connected to the world than I ever have before. And I think it's because of the mediums and the tools that we have to really know so much more immediately what is happening and to make those connections. And I just have to hope, what I see is things breaking down. I mean, the normal order of things breaking down, because we are able to relate to what's happening with people on the street in Egypt and with people in Syria, in all these different places. And I think in terms of Israel-Palestine, we have to demand that international law be recognized. We have to demand that the human rights, the freedom, the dignity of all the people in the region be addressed, and that the rights, certainly the rights of Palestinians in the diaspora, their right of return, that be recognized. There can't, I just believe very strongly that there can't be peace in the region without acknowledgement and addressing that right that belongs to all of us individually. If somebody came here to Olympia, if Canadians took over my land that I'm sitting on right now, I would have a right under international law. And Craig does a very good job of always pointing out that nobody has the power to give that away. Those are just some of the thoughts that come to mind for me as I hear your caller. And very much for me, the only way that I can proceed, you know, to continue to work on all this, though, is to try to hold in my heart compassion and love for all the people that are involved in the situation. And it's sometimes very difficult to do. But I do see good people who want to make the change happen. And I also remember the stories coming from, even from Gaza in 2009, from the head of the World Council, or from the World Council of Churches there. There was a Christian in Gaza, one of 2,000 or 3,000 Christians in Gaza, and he remembers as being a refugee at 7 years old from Haifa in 1947-1948. And he talks about a time when his family, he remembers, was able to return, and his mother falling into the arms of the Jewish neighbor, person who had been a Jewish neighbor. The two women had been close friends, and how they cried because of the separation that had happened. And I draw belief and hope, you know, that things can get better if we from stories like that. So I just felt compelled to share that.
And thank you so much. Craig, your thoughts?
Well, I think that the caller pointed out a lot of historical fact there. The only question I would give, to me, you know, things have to change, but it's the actions and the policies that need to change. And so when you hear that anger, I would just call people to focus it on the acts of, and many of those acts certainly are by the government of Israel, but what I want to see changed is, and so sort of voicing anger and hatred maybe for the acts, and even when you go to say it's the government of Israel, we don't necessarily have to eliminate Israel. We have to change, and the Palestinians will tell you this, yeah, we recognize Israel. Israel's right there. We can see it. But the occupation has to change, the way it treats its neighbors, the way it treats the indigenous people that are still inside its own borders. All of that has to change, and that's what we have to work on.
All right, we're going to break. We'll be right back. All righty, welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guests today are Cindy and Craig Corey, the parents of Rachel Corey. The website is rachelcoreyfoundation.org. And I do have an audio that I would like to play. So let's go ahead and play that, and then we'll take another caller.
I've been here for about a month and a half now, and this is definitely the most difficult situation that I've ever seen. In the time that I've been here, children have been shot and killed. On the 30th of January, the Israeli military bulldozed the two largest water wells, destroying over half of Rafah's water supply. Every few days, if not every day, houses are demolished here. People are economically devastated because of the closure of the borders into Egypt and the extreme control of the Gazan economy by Israel. I came to look at the aftermath of a place where 25 greenhouses had been demolished on the other side of Rafah, destroying the livelihoods of about 300 people, and that had taken place while they rounded up about 150 men, held them under a sniper tower, and shot around them to contain the men, the farmers in the area. So I feel like what I'm witnessing here is a very systematic destruction of people's ability to survive, and that is incredibly horrifying. Incredibly horrifying. Sometimes it takes a while for it to set in what is happening here, because I think many of the people here, they try to maintain what they can of their lives. And I think, I don't know, maybe it has to do with protecting their children, that they try to be happy, joke with their children. So sometimes it takes time to, it's hard to hold in your mind, you know, the complete reality of what's happening here. Sometimes I'm sitting down to dinner with people and I just realize that that there is a massive military machine surrounding them and trying to kill these people that I'm having dinner with, these families that I'm sitting down to eat with, and who are being very generous and kind to me and their children here who are incredibly threatened, living lives that no child ever should have to live. And so it, I feel a lot of horror, really. I feel a lot of horror about the situation. The current Israeli government, I don't have a great deal of faith that they're going to listen to any message from me. I think it has become clear that this government does not care about the safety of its own people and doesn't care at all about the lives of Palestinian people. I think it's ridiculous that my government supports this government and referred to Ariel Sharon as a man of peace. It's clear to me, being here, that Ariel Sharon is invested in perpetuating a cycle well, perpetuating violence. I think calling it a cycle of violence disregards the imbalance of power in this situation, that people's lives here are almost completely controlled by the Israeli government. And it's amazing that people are able to hold on to their humanity as much as they have.
All righty. That was Rachel. And I think, well, thank you for playing that audio. Did we have another caller? Did we have another caller? Patty in New York. Patty, very quickly, we have 1 minute.
Okay. Mr. and Mrs. Corey, I think you have handled the cold-blooded murder of your daughter in a very civilized manner. You've always been polite. You've taken the high road. but I'm wondering, you're obviously from your crash course in what's happening over in the Middle East. You're not dealing with civilized, rational, compassionate people or people who are capable of guilt. So I'm wondering, can you ever admit, even in the privacy of your own heart, that the Jew is a predator and is really not part of the human family?
Well, I think that they've already answered that question, Patty. So,
okay.
Thank you.
I just say, you know, we've had so much help from Jewish people from all over the world, including inside Israel, that that's never been a question in our mind of trying to attribute any of this to Jewish people or Jews. It's an action of a military state. And let's just leave it at that.
Right.
And I would just say, you know, and I appreciate the characterization of how we've handled the situation. One thing that I really worked hard to instill in my children is that the only behavior, the only person's behavior that I can absolutely control is my own.
Absolutely.
And absolutely. So I think that our family has tried very much to do the work that we do and to pursue accountability in a way that is this.
Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guests today are Cindy and Craig Corey, the parents of Rachel Corey. The website is rachelcoreyfoundation.org. And Cindy, you were saying something incredibly profound. You said that you can only control your own behavior, and that is so true. This monstrous thing that has occurred to Rachel and has affected your entire family, you cannot allow that to affect the loving people that you are and the loving parents that raised Rachel to be the kind of person that she was.
Well, thank you for that. And I think that consciously or unconsciously and by trying to hold on to each other from the very beginning, and it's not easy in a situation like this, but that Craig and I and our other family members, we knew, I mean, we had a sense that if we allowed hate and revenge to enter into our thinking about all of this, and it, I can say quite honestly that it never really has, and Some people wonder about that. One of Rachel's friends at the time asked about that, said, "I'm too sad to be angry." And I think that really characterized for me what I felt at the time as well. But I think we knew if we allowed hatred and revenge to be a part of our approach, that that would end up destroying us. I think we've done our best to avoid all of that. I also want to say, you know, that I think, you know, racism that we all can fall victim to, or that we can all be responsible for, that we have to look for it and challenge it in ourselves and wherever we see it, because it actually contributes, I think, in this particular situation, it contributes to what continues to happen against the Palestinian people. And so whether it's a form of racism that takes the form of anti-Semitism or Islamophobia, you know, all the forms of that just make this situation much, much harder.
Certainly.
So I think we have to try to do what we can to challenge it within ourselves and wherever we see it.
Sure. Take the high road. All righty. We do have some other callers. Let's take Jim in Georgia. Jim, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My heart goes out to Cindy and Craig, and I feel sorry what has happened to them. And I just feel that Israel's justice is not like ours. Of course, ours is not that great, but our symbol is a woman with scales and a blindfold. I think Israel is a woman with a blindfold, earplugs, and a tongue cut out. So, and I'm like Deanna. I know I choke up a lot when I hear the tragedies that happen to people there. My opinion is probably not that heavy with other people, but I just feel the American people need to buy guns, have them, lock them up, put trigger locks on them, and have a gun, because when you go to most of these countries and you find out that all they have is tomatoes and rocks to throw back against the government suppression, it's awful.
Okay.
Yeah. Your words, not mine, right there at the beginning about justice. I think it's in the last few years, when you look at some of what's happened in what they call the Arab Spring, the tomatoes and rocks in some ways turn out to be powerful, so very powerful. So like Martin Luther King, like Gandhi, in some ways like what our daughter Rachel and her friends, the friends that are in fact going back into Gaza now in the last couple of weeks, are doing. I think there's a lot of power in the nonviolent resistance in some ways. It ends up in the arc of history as being more powerful, but that requires that we all do our part about looking at the issue, about paying attention to it. I think I sort of say the reason Gandhi was effective is because the English finally became horrified at the horrifying things that the English were doing. And that part's our job, and the job of television shows like and radio shows like this, to bring it forward to people and for us to change our governments. And I think that we can do that, and I hope that does not take guns anymore. I think we have to get away from that. So, you know, I had a gun growing up. I went pheasant hunting in Iowa, those were different times, and I enjoyed that time with my uncle and father and his friends. But this is a different situation when you turn them on people. And my heart continues. I'm just overwhelmed with the thought of another huge tragedy in an American school.
Well, like I say, my heart is heavy for you, and you've gone through a great tragedy, and God bless you. But yes, people need to be prepared in this country. They need to be prepared. I'm not a person that wants to revolt against the government, but you need to protect yourself and your family.
Okay, thank you, Jim.
I'm going to let you go. I'm sorry, but I'm like Deanna. I choke up, and it really it hurts me inside my heart. It really does.
Thank you, people.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Jim. All righty, let's take Michael in New York. Michael, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you, Deanna. Definitely extremely sympathetic towards Mr. and Mrs. Corey. Dan, I want to thank you for presenting this in detail. We can hear the parents. It's just heart-wrenching, to say the least. And, you know, when we consider how they trash everybody over there in Israel, that's not one of them. They despise them. They look down on them as if they're nothing but dirt. And then we consider what they did to the U.S. Liberty in the 60s during the Six-Day War, and killed many sailors and tried to sink the ship. They're obviously not our ally or our friend. Why we're giving them $10 million a day proves how they control our government and that we, as the people of this country, must reclaim our government one way or the other. Now, the previous caller, I have to agree on what his comments were pertaining to the fact that, you see, guns eventually are the only other tool at our disposal to shut down evil when it manifests, and it's using superior weaponry over tomatoes and rocks and bats, clubs. And so eventually, those tools are needed. Now, I'm a strict vegetarian. I don't harm a thing. I go out of my way helping animals, people, birds, you name it. It's a full-time job, it seems like, these days. And yet, I don't harm anything. And yet, I have guns because the day ever comes somebody breaks in and tries to harm, you know, anybody in my family, and they have weapons and stuff, well, you got to be ready. And that's why it's just a tool. And it doesn't cause murder or killing or mayhem. People cause that, just like any other tool. You can take a hammer and use it to be constructive, or you can use it to be destructive and harm and kill anything with that hammer. And so regarding that, we have, as Americans, that's why they're after our guns, because they know we can defend ourselves. And these Bolshevik communists that are into this globalism, they're after our guns, and the gun shootings in schools are all staged in order to bring this about here under the guise that guns are evil. But no, it's all staged, and we have to just be fully aware of that, as we are, of how these Israeli government is so brutal, Nazi communist-like, towards anybody that isn't one of them. And
okay,
we
have... Thank you, Michael. We do need to... Okay, thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. Okay, bye-bye.
All righty. Craig, your comments.
Well, again, I think I disagree in parts of that. I just think that once we go to the violence, once we let that violence into our own hearts and into our society, that we can't really control it. And so I think that's really part of a problem. And as Cindy was saying, we have to look into our own hearts first in trying to stomp that sort of stuff out, and then into our society and our governments that reflect that.
I'm reminded that I heard Rudy Giuliani, former New York mayor, interviewed just last night, I think, on TV, and he was questioned about the shootings that had happened recently in another mall, and his position, I think, was very much like your last callers, and that is that if the people in the mall had had handguns, they would have been able to take out the person that killed some people in that mall. And I found myself so startled by that, coming from a leader in the country, because of what I could envision happening in such a situation. And I think I understand that we have a right to bear arms, and I understand that your caller, I appreciate what he said about how he's living his life to just protect all that he can. But I think we have a difference of opinion about the role, you know, that guns have in our society, or how they could or could not serve as any protection for people in these kinds of circumstances that can come up. And I'm reading today about Rachel's friends in Gaza who are going with the farmers in Gaza without weapons to the farmland on Palestinian land that they have not been able to farm. But I'm thinking about the power and the courage of those farmers to go out to their land, and I've been near there. I looked at that land just a few weeks ago. I didn't go out to the border where they are because it's been too dangerous to do that. But today and yesterday and the day before, the farmers are going, and there are international from the U.S., from Spain, from Germany, from a host of different countries going with them without weapons. And I think our job is to really communicate what's happening there, the threat that they come under, and the justification, the right of what they're doing and what they're pursuing. And those are very different situations from what we're finding here in the U.S. in our schools and so forth, but I think there are some parallels. We need to dig deeply and get to the root causes of things.
I think Cindy's right to make those connections, and while she was talking, I was just thinking that, to me, it's... if it weren't so tragic, it's almost comical to think that, you know, having a shootout at the OK Corral be in one of our malls would somehow be better. And that kind of translates to our foreign policy, where we in the United States fund Israel to $3 billion, this year $4 billion of, and that's military equipment, and then we go give less than half of that, but another billions of dollars, so over 10 years is supposed to be $30 billion, well, $40 billion, I believe, in the area, but we give that to other Arab countries, and to send billions of dollars of military goods to the Middle East to encourage peace is like sending a truck full of beer to a fraternity to encourage sobriety. It's just, if it weren't so tragic, it would be comical. It just doesn't make sense.
Good analogy. Absolutely. Why don't we take Brian? Brian in Boston. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Deanna.
Hi.
I'm calling to see, does anybody ever do a real in-depth background check of these supposed shooters and see what their backgrounds are, where they come from, and so on? I'm convinced that a lot of this is MK Ultra. These are program people, and they go off and do certain things. If you look at the background of these individuals and follow it up, you'll find some shady stuff in their background.
Oh, I'm sure you might be right, Brian. So,
but the mainstream media doesn't do that. All they do is they do a 24, 48-hour reporting on this incident, then it dies down, and you don't hear about it again.
Yeah, well, that's what happens in the media on a lot of issues. We certainly didn't hear about Rachel Corey.
Oh, yes. I mean, she was run over by a bulldozer twice.
Yes.
But anyway, I think the mainstream media in this country drops the ball on real journalism and real reporting.
Certainly does. So thank
you
so much.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. And that is certainly true of on incidences like what happened to Rachel. If people knew about it at the time, if it was actually reported at the time, I think that there would have been a lot of outcry, absolutely a lot of outcry, if they had reported about the USS Liberty, which is still very concealed. Perhaps we could prevent further violence. And certainly we don't hear in the media what is really going on in Gaza.
Yeah. I'm afraid that's true, and I think that word has to get out. I think that particularly in the United States, but all over the world, there's an innate fairness that when we start to understand a situation that we can deal with, and we recognize when things aren't fair, and we want them to be a little more fair. So I just wish that our government and our media would report on the area, and I would say make sure that your reporting is exactly the same. Use the same language if a rocket is fired out of Gaza that you use when artillery shells are fired back into Gaza, and treat it equally. And I think that our understanding, if we did that for just a month, I think the American people would see the drastic difference in the resources that people have and the violence that's going on there, and we find a much more fair foreign policy, and it would be much cheaper and more productive.
Exactly. We are going to a break momentarily, and certainly what is going on there. I think, of course, that there are more Palestinians that have been affected by violence than there have been Israeli citizens.
I don't think that Craig wants to mean that we should equate the situation at all. There's a huge differential in power.
Absolutely.
But I think he just means that.
Fair reporting, certainly.
Yeah.
Alrighty, we do have to take our 3-minute break. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. Deanna and our guests today have been Cindy and Craig Corey, the parents of Rachel Corey. Their website is rachelcoreyfoundation.org. And just a real quick update, as of 1:42, the shooter, age 24, is dead within the school. And he, as I said, he was 24. And there are children, mostly young children, who were shot, and tragic. Very tragic. As tragic as your daughter being murdered. And what can our listeners do to help to carry the work that you are doing forward?
Well, thank you for sharing the website with folks, and people can get onto our mailing list to receive communications about actions to take. I would just encourage folks to pay attention to the specifics of things, the specific details. It's something I try to do, and to not get too discouraged. I think more and more people are aware. I actually think the media coverage around this issue has improved during the 10 years that we've been watching it closely. In the recent attacks on Gaza, CNN was there, and at least it depended on which hour you watched, whether they were broadcasting, you know, from Israel or from Gaza. But the coverage from Gaza was really quite good and informed on the part of some of the reporters who were bringing that news. So I think we can encourage that. When we see it being positive, we can applaud it. When we see the opposite, we can let people know that they left out too much of the story. And I also want to say the same about government. I work with a lot of people who are really opposed. The big thing right now is to get involved with BDS on this issue. Boycotts, divestment efforts, and those are so important. We are supportive of that. This is in response to the call from Palestinians to use this as a form of nonviolent resistance, and it is having an impact. But I think we shouldn't give up on addressing the role of the U.S. in this, that your callers have brought up too. And to know that we should be going, talking to our representatives, to our senators, about the situation right now in Gaza, about what's happening to the farmers and how that ceasefire is being broken, and also how we feel about the funding, because the opposition is there advocating for more and more money to go to military weapons that support the Israeli position. So I think we have to be present advocating for the opposite.
Indeed. Well, it's been delightful having both of you on the program. Thank you for your charitable hearts and for being the courageous parents of a courageous young woman.
Thank you, Deanna.
Thank you, Deanna. And our hearts again go out to those school children and their families today.
You know exactly how they feel, don't you?
Well,
yeah, it's
part of
horrible
it, yeah.
To think of the... we share... Anybody who loses a child shares that loss, but it's horrible to think about
the violence.
Multiple tragedy there.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Bye now.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye, listeners. Talk to you on Monday.